welcome, everybody. We're waiting for Francesca Albanese to come. She's had a very busy schedule over at the United Nations. And we will be, as the American subway system says, momentarily letting her in. I've never understood that momentarily, because momentarily means for a tiny instant. They mean soon. But anyway, enough of my chauvinistic prejudices here. I was, welcome to the session, Foreign Press Association in New York, as always, interested in the Middle East, and we're interested in the United Nations. We have followed the United Nations, and we take a slightly distance. We don't do an inside baseball job as if we were based in the UN, although some of our members are, but we do look at it in a global sense. And often people ask, I'm filling in here while we're waiting, Francesca, why is the UN so obsessed with the Middle East problem? Well, it's quite simple. The UN created the Middle East problem. It was the UN's partition resolution and the hasty actions voted on by the General Assembly, one might note, in 1948, which created the current condition. It created the armistice lines. It created the Jewish state, which is very ungrateful for it. It promised a Palestinian state, which the Palestinians are still waiting for. And of course, it has passed many resolutions since then, which are, I want to discuss with Francesca, always considered non-binding when the General Assembly resolutions. And the people like Francesca have been assailed in advance to defang whatever they say. Here she is. Good, good. Hello, Francesca.
Hi.
Hello. It's okay, your hair's fine.
Sorry. I've been running around all morning. Nice to meet you, Jan, and nice to see you, Mark.
Yeah, I've just been making groveling apologies for you in terms of your busyness in the UN today. So.
Yeah, it was a crazy day, and I've never met so many journalists in my entire life today in one.
Ooh, make sure you have a hot shower afterwards.
yeah. But no, I'm happy to see that the report is gaining traction. That's interesting.
Well, okay, let us begin then. I am Ian Williams, president of the Foreign Press Association. We're joined by Mark Seddon, who's director of the UN Center for the University of Buckingham. And if Mark could raise his head at the moment, he's hiding his chin under the level on my screen.
Yes.
Good, that's right. Step up a lip and all the rest of it. And I will introduce Mark now so he can tell us about the work of our co-sponsors for this, the UN Foundation. So, Mark, take it away.
Well, thank you, Ian. I mean, Ian and I actually go back about 30-odd years when we worked on Tribune together in the British press. And also, of course, in New York, Ian has been president of the UN Correspondents Association. Of course, he now leads the Foreign Press Association. So I've worked with Ian for many, many years. And I also worked at the United Nations. I worked as a speechwriter for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. And when I left the UN, we set up a Centre for UN Studies here in England at the University of Buckingham. It offers an MA degree in UN and diplomatic studies. Ian's a member of our board, and the chairman of our board is Lord Mark Malloch Brown, who, as many of you will remember, was the former Deputy Secretary General under Kofi Annan. So absolutely delighted, by the way, to have been able to meet Francesca online so far, but some months ago, and hearing about her work and this report which she has given to the third committee today, and seeing the amount of interest and publicity it is generating for its sheer honesty. And I think that's a very, very powerful thing. Francesca will no doubt be speaking about all of this, but it's a very profound intervention in many of our views, whether wherever we come from on this issue, it's a very, very powerful intervention. So we're delighted to be able to be a co-host of this with the Foreign Press Association, with all of you wonderful correspondents in New York, and of course, with Ian. So back to you, Ian.
Thank you, Mark. And I'd love to introduce Francesca. I've been reading the report, and it is almost as epoch-making as Mark said, because, as you know, UN reports are often more significant for what they don't say than what they say. People are very, very careful. They're treading through a literary minefield. And the people who support Israel in general have a long track record of preemptively shouting down anybody who might disagree with them or might come out with something. And I noticed when I read the report that the Israeli government refused to let Francesca into the occupied territories and refused to meet with her. So now I can confidently predict with the accuracy of Nostradamus that we will be getting complaints that we had no input in this report. It's biased and one-sided because I've seen it happen over and over again. So the significant part here is that Francesca is calling attention to the United Nations, which always tries to make things the question of or the conflict between. And this report very definitively says it's not a conflict, it's a colony, it's a colonization. And that's a sort of, that is a quantum leap for UN diplomatic talk. So Francesca, can you explain what you see as different about this report from the many others that have, say, skirted the problem or approached the problem, and what actions you think are necessary to, against the preemptive war of attrition that's been waged against the report and will be from now on?
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's really a privilege to be with you. Three things. First of all, I would like to qualify what I mean, it's surely is meant as a compliment to say that this report is striking for its honesty. I do think that, for example, the reports of my predecessors, Richard Falk, John Dugard, Michael Link, have always been striking in terms of honesty. What is probably different with this one, it's comprehensiveness. It puts everything together, history within the limitation of my mandate, the political failure, the political abolaya toward the question, and it's a holistic approach to international law. So this is probably what is new. Let me address the last point, and then I'm happy to elaborate a little bit about the content of the report, if you allow me. So
please, yes.
Look, I was shocked today. I will be very honest. I was shocked by the debate because, you know, I was sitting on the podium with the Commission of Inquiry. So there was a 1 hour debate around their report, which frankly states, I mean, in a normal context, it is the obvious because it was already fully documented that the occupation is unlawful. But seriously, but what did it take to people to see that 55 years without rights, it's abnormal. 55 years with boots on the ground of another country is abnormal. 55 years of brutality and colonization, because Israel, how come that in 55 years, the Jewish colonist population has grown from zero to 800,000. How do you call it? I mean, I really don't know what is so shocking of calling it settler colonialism and what has been so shocking in the past. So, but I was surprised because the Israeli ambassador was so virulent against the Commission of Inquiry, and Navi Pillai was frankly she's an institution. I mean, it's not that she's the no one, she's an institution, she embodies justice and the commitment of human rights. She's been sitting on two or three of the most important international tribunals. So, you know, it's a lot of barking at an airplane, but at the same time, all the Western states repeated the same talking points and without anyone tackling the substance of this report. So this is the reality we lead from. And my report, just again, is a comprehensive reading. Israel has violated for 55 years, willfully, intentionally, it has engineered the prevention of the realization of the right of self-determination in its constitutive elements: sovereignty over the territory, sovereignty over natural resources to promote and to achieve economic development of the Palestinian people in what remains of their ancestral land, and it has violated the right of self-determination, preventing the formation of a political, of a polity, of a political will, of a political movement. And look, we are at the point of even suppressing Palestinian human rights organizations and human rights defenders. And last but not least, preventing the raising Palestinian identity culturally, educationally, archaeologically. Whatever symbol of Palestinian identity is a threat to the regime, and which is pushing to the de-Palestinianization of the occupied territory. Again, these are all hallmarks of settler colonialism. This is what I concluded in my report.
One of my thoughts, you mentioned Nabi Pillay and the others, let's just say that all of your predecessors have one thing in common. Their career prospects were not desperately enhanced by touching this third rail or swinging from the 25,000 volts overhead wire, more like it, on this issue. And, part of the purpose of that has obviously been to try and get them to temporize. And many people inside the UN community and the diplomatic community, and we might say, for example, in the British Labour Party and the US Democratic Party, who choose their words very carefully because of the possible consequences of disagreeing. And you saw some of that today. Mm-hmm. When the incoming incompetence, I'm being a bit biased here, in the British government, the first thing they say is, oh yes, let's recognise Jerusalem. It's almost the first item. So this means that you're fighting against the diplomatic stream, even if you're fighting with the legal stream.
Yeah, but you know what I've realized, really, and again, I think it's a fair, depressing reading of the situation. This attitude to shelter certain states from criticism, and these virulence in pointing to the others, vilifying the others, whoever tries to utter a word against it, is typical of a sort of brotherhood. You know, it's turning the protection in human rights, which is supposed to be universal, into protectionism, which is a way to vanify and to pulverize the power of international law in its normative and remedial function. So human rights are just for a group of friends. But this is why, I mean, I could see clearly where the debate regarding Palestine is at the UN. The states who realize, who empathized with Palestine, are those in the global south, those who have broken the chains and the yoke of colonization, those who have gone through colonization. And 30 years ago, Ian, the discussion was exactly what I was trying to bring back. I've not reinvented the wheel. I've simply read the acts of the deliberations of the General Assembly of 50 or 40 years ago. And it was the question: Israeli occupation was treated and condemned in the context of colonialism. Then the Oslo process has changed the attitude, the temperature, and the language. But we need to go back to that, because it has been a detour, but we are still at square zero in terms of advancement of international law. And in the meantime, the occupation has turned more vicious.
Francesca, I wonder if I might ask, what in terms of for those attending and viewing who haven't read your report, what are your main recommendations for action?
Yeah. My main recommendations is, first of all, I mean, I've advocated for a paradigm shift, which consists, first of all, of changing diagnostic. and using the correct language and the correct framework. This is why I say, yes, it's an illegal occupation. Yes, it entails the crime of apartheid and other crimes. But this is, look at the intent, because if you look at the intent, you will be able to address what causes it. And so to realign the current of approach to the reality and the norms, and then to correct the second is to correct the approach, because the tendency is to really insist on the negotiation, which is not normal, because which other colonized people has been asked to negotiate with its colonizer? If colonization needs to end, full stop. And military troops should be out of the occupied territory, full stop. I'm not calling for an uprooting of the settlers, but their supremacy, their privilege should end. And then we will see who would remain in the occupied territory, in what is today the occupied territory. The other two things that I criticize is this humanitarianism, humanitarian approach, the tendency to consider the occupied Palestinian territory as a humanitarian issue to imagine instead of a political quagmire to solve in line with international law. And also the emphasis on the economic development without a political horizon. So this also needs to be overcome. So adjusting the language, adjusting the approach, and realizing that the right of self-determination is a peremptory norms of international law, which suffers no derogation, and it's erga omnes, so imposes obligations on everyone. What does it mean? That on top of doing what I said, calling it out, the states are obliged not to assist and not to recognize the legal consequences of an illegal act, but also to take measures and to take measures against it, to make sure that it's seized and to make sure that it results into corrections, reparations, and reassurance of non-repetition.
So this obviously has implications in the attempts to make boycott and disinvestment schemes illegal in various countries and states, because, mm-hmm. of course, that is legitimate if the occupation is illegal, which is accepted by everybody except the Israelis, I think. Yeah. Even the US government doesn't say it's a legal occupation. It says pragmatically, maybe we should accept it. The Canadians have a beautiful dichotomy, schizophrenia. Their website says it's an illegal occupation, and then its government speaks as though it isn't. It's pragmatic settlement that we've come to. So there's all of this takes us back to South Africa, which is where this battle was first fought, and where many of the people who are now supporting Israel used to support South African apartheid, or they didn't support it. They condemned it, but then made sure that nothing was done about it. I remember, because I was expelled from university about protesting on South Africa, so I studied it quite closely at the time. And then we were told that, how can you say you can't eat Outspan oranges? How can you ban the South African wine or call for a boycott? Because it's the product of apartheid and the UN resolutions about it. But now what this confusion and the shouting has managed to do is to create a wiggle room for people to say, well, they're not occupied. They are disputed territories, which is the phrase that's usually used legally. And, I say, well, yes, of course it's disputed. You know, the British could dispute the ownership of Australia. They used to own it, and they say we still could if we wanted to. I don't think anyone would listen to them. Can you comment on the legal, this is both a legal and a political maneuver to confuse the issue between disputed and occupied. Can you restate, not for my benefit, for everybody, why are the territories occupied?
I'm not sure it's a legal maneuver. It's a political maneuver to not apply international law. Because again, I mean, probably no other situation that I can imagine. It's the violations of international law are so well documented as in the case of the occupied Palestinian territory, and it's really clear, because an occupation, it's true, there is no limit in international law, international humanitarian law, which there, I mean, there is no provision that stipulates this is the limit by which an occupation must end. But international humanitarian law is a temporary regime meant to govern the emergency of the conflict or the occupation itself. It's never been envisaged to last in perpetuity. And in fact, there is jurisprudence of the ICJ, which has said, they just concluded what is said now also for the case of Apiti, that an occupation that is not temporary, is not carried out in the interest of the occupied population, which is translated into an annexation of the territory, which cannot be recognized because it's absolutely prohibited. The conquest is not part of the legal system that emerged from the ashes of the World War II. So you see how precious this conquest is, but it's also illegal because it's violating at least the three peremptory norms of international law, which is the prohibition of establishing a racial discriminatory apartheid regime, and also the prohibition of annexation and the prohibition of the violation of the right of self-determination. So, where is the disputed territories? This is the language that the colonizer has chosen in order to proceed with constructive ambiguity. But this is not just international law. International consensus as of 1947, and they can claim the Palestinians have refused the state. Of course, I've refused the state in 1947. But the point is that now we are in 2022. And they are claiming their right, their sovereignty over 22% of what remain of their ancestral land.
Francesca, if I may just very briefly, because when you were talking about historical comparisons in a way, because Southwest Africa, which was a trustee territory of South Africa, as you recall, after the ending of the First World War, I mean, that trusteeship was brought to an end by the United Nations, and South Africa was told to leave. It continued to occupy and also to administer law via apartheid policy. So there's a direct correlation there. So there's a question, I suppose, which might come out. I'm not sure if your report addressed it, but in terms of trying to move beyond all of this and to end settler colonialism and end the occupation, is there any real mileage, or is it just too far gone to do anything about it, to have essentially a trusteeship relationship with the occupied territories, whereby there is an international administration of the occupied territories until they can be free and recognized?
I've not thought of it, but I don't think so.
I think the Palestinians have suffered enough. An international administration by the UN would be really over icing.
Exactly. No, I mean, you know, they've had, to be totally frank, Mark, the Palestinians are among the few people in the world that the colonizers, I mean, because Europe has colonized most of the world and at different stages. But, and this is important because we as Europeans have a responsibility to come to terms with our past, because if we do not manage to decolonize our minds, it will be impossible to see what needs to be seen through the eyes of those who suffer the legacy of the colonialism. But however, the Palestinians, as other people who were part of the former Ottoman Empire, were recognized self-determination in the forms of provisional independence before even the right of self-determination became universally recognized. And the people of Palestine, a majority Muslim and a minority Christian and Jews, were part of it. Why did it happen? Because of during the British mandate, it happened what it happened. And so the Palestinians have paid the brunt of European responsibilities and atrocities. But again, we need to acknowledge the past to see how to deliver justice and a human rights approach today. Does it make sense? So I don't think that I would go with proposing what I think that's unnecessary in the immediate, is a protective presence, because what's going on in the occupied Palestinian territory is horrendous. And there are 22 Israelis who have lost their lives since the beginning of the year, and 180 plus and counting Palestinians, 40 among 40 of them are kids. So we need to stop this bloodshed. We need to. It's an international responsibility, and it's getting out of control for real.
Yes.
But we come back to whatever methods we're talking about to deal with this. Now, as I remember, in Southwest Africa, the interesting point was that it was the General Assembly made the decisions, because it was a mandate, it was a trustee territory. So the General Assembly made the decisions. And for the last 50 or 60 years, we have been told by certain people that General Assembly resolutions are not legally, not legally binding. Which I basically think is rubbish. If the judge says it's there, the question is whether you agree to abide by it is another story, but that's they're legally binding. The law is clear and it's been stated. Would you like that? That's really, it's not just crept up, it's galloped through. You see this phrase over and over again. It's not applied to the partition of Palestine in 1948. It wasn't applied to the furtherance of the war in Korea, where General Assembly was quite good enough because the West had a majority. How would you stand on the legal standing of General Assembly resolutions and General Assembly proposals?
Yeah, look, to tell you the truth, and because I've looked at the situation through the experience of Palestinian refugees, there is nothing, including the right of return, that is not set in international law, including treaties and customary law. So most of the time, what the General Assembly does is reaffirming or interpreting international law. I mean, the majority interpretation is that what is legally binding is treaties, and this is the case. Treaties generate obligations. At the same time, I agree with you in the sense it's a bit disingenuous to say, well, I don't abide with what the General Assembly does. I mean, again, it doesn't really suggest good faith, especially, I mean, in the case of the occupied Palestinian territory, there are hundreds of resolutions of the General Assembly.
Francesca, there's almost been a degree from what Ian and what you were both saying, a sort of paradigm shift because of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and the breach of the charter. And suddenly some of those member states who have been rather dismissive about the General Assembly in the past are becoming very supportive of General Assembly resolutions as regards illegal occupation of territories in Ukraine.
Yeah, I know. And again, but this is untenable. This is why I'm saying, look, double standards have always existed. And there is a different attitude toward non-Western countries. I mean, I see that. Now, Ukraine is different because it's... No, it's not different because it's very close to Europe, and so it's sort of part of what Europe considers its own territory patch. In a way. Sorry,
its own patch.
but again, the exceptionalism that has been permitted to Israel is quite interesting, and it has tarnished the reputation of the United Nations, and it has weakened the force of international law. It has set a very negative precedent, and again, it's emboldening others to act in defiance of international laws and a rules-based order on a regular basis.
Well, it was cited frequently by my colleagues in the South that if Ukraine, then why not Palestine or vice versa? Yeah. It was the constant theme, and it's one of the reasons why, disappointingly, I think some of the major southern countries have actually supported Moscow's invasion, or at least not supported, at least they protested less vigorously than they should have done by their own ethical standards.
I agree. So it's a principled... So a quote unquote, it's a principled stand against the unprincipled and sort of cherry picking attitude of certain Western states, in particular the US.
Can I say, anybody who's got any questions, specifically questions, because blissfully it's only on a chat, please put it on the chat. No speeches, because we'll just ignore them. Don't take up too much of the chat. If you have a specific question for Francesca.
But we cannot listen to them.
You'll see it on the chat screen, or you should do, and I will read them to you if they're good questions. Come on, people. But you know, this has been a contentious bit. I watched this. I came to the UN, God, over 30 years ago, when it was axiomatic for almost every country, what you might call the high tide. Even Margaret Thatcher voted against Israeli occupation frequently. She defied the US veto. That's my personal standard of, wow, how can you beat that? And most European countries were saying, yes, what Israel is doing is wrong. At the same time, we've got to cut them some slack because of what we did to Jews during the Second World War. That was the attitude. But they still very axiomatically said, this is illegal, what's going on, and we deplore it. And that's been almost completely eroded in the last 10 or 15 years. I've watched what you call the paradigm shift. I hate the phrase, but I'll use it on this occasion, where people are prepared to say, well, we have to make an exception. Or even more so, they don't say that. They imply it, but they don't get challenged enough about it. So you've challenged them. What do you think they will do?
It takes time. It takes time for political actors to let this kind of bombshells sink in. So I think it requires a lot. I hope, look, it as it was in the case of South Africa, the reality in Israel, Palestine will not change because of the reality in New York. This is my feeling. But there is a need, an impetus for a new pact of solidarity with those who stand for human rights and justice in Israel and Palestine. And I want to be very clear. It's something that affects the Palestinians enormously, disproportionately. But in the past 5 months, I've also come to reckon the reality of the minority of Israelis who try to stand by the side of the Palestinians. They're as voiceless as anyone else. So, and the Jewish communities who try to stand with the Palestinians, and they don't want this to be done in their name. So we need to find spaces for dialogue and to have more of these voices triggered and heard, because there is a new, again, as I said, new solidarity with a massive mobilization of civil society. This is what is needed. Mm-hmm. And then, again, it's going to get much worse before it gets better. This is what I feel. But I am confident that we will see the end of it. It cannot last forever. And the more aggressive it gets, it shows its weakness.
Mm-hmm. Francesca, can I just very briefly, Francesca, because, I mean, people watching this in the US, also over here in the UK, they may not have read your report, but they're listening to you and they probably will go and read your report. The thing is, they know that you're the UN special rapporteur. You were tasked by the Secretary General of the United Nations to make this report, to give it to the General Assembly. And what I think a lot of people find it difficult is why and how were you prevented from actually traveling to the West Bank to see for yourself? How did you go about your request to go to the West Bank? How were you refused?
No, let me frame it, because technically I've not been prevented. Let me explain how it works. Israel doesn't engage with my mandate. Israel, when I took the floor, after using its 10 minutes during their interactive dialogue to insult the Commission of Inquiry, was there, and then they left the room the moment I took the floor. So this is the level of engagement. They do not recognize my mandate. I mean, this mandate, they have not engaged with it since John Dugard, Richard Falk, Michael Link, and there was another one, Wibisono, for 2 years. They do not engage in the sense they do not respond to requests for meetings. They do not respond to letters of allegations where we try to pick up cases that are really, really painful and must be resolved on the ground of humanity before even on the ground of legality. They don't respond. And then, of course, I mean, I've sent my report to the government of Israel for reading, and I've received no response while I received quite intense comments by the state of Palestine. And as I do, I engage also on violations that occur not at the hands of Israeli forces, and I receive response. And this and the authorities engage with me. So this is why it's also different, the kind of relationship. Now, I want to go to Palestine. This is a reality which I know fairly well because I've lived there and I've gone continuously since I, even after leaving the occupied Palestinian territory, because I worked for UNRWA there, and then I've done research for a book. So I was very invested in the reality on the ground for research. But again, I think that I also need to understand how I want to set the discussion with Israel in terms of going, because again, Israel doesn't have sovereignty over the Palestinian territory. And so I don't think that we should acknowledge as a matter of fact the reality that Israel prohibits by simply not giving visas. So I'm still figuring out the best way to go, because again, I think that just abiding by what Israel, I mean, any capricious policy is it risks to normalize the brutality of the occupation. Make sense?
Yes. Well, one of the complicating aspects here is people trying to understand, you know, the Israelis will say, well, we've given them a state. They've got the Palestinian Authority.
And excuse me?
The Israelis will claim that, you know, they've got the Palestinian Authority. We allowed that. What more did they want? And yet it often seems the Palestinian Authority are acting as a sort of sepoys, local troops on behalf of the occupation. Or, you know, at least when you see Palestinian police standing by as settlers attack Palestinian villages because they're under orders not to interfere. And how much does this complicate the issue for raising legal objections?
Okay, first of all, I'm really uncomfortable, not with what you're saying, but with the language we have given them. You see how condescending and patronizing and
I was quoting a hypothetical.
This is the discussion. This is the discussion. I'm saying it's not directed at you, but I would like you to unpack this, because it's not about a concession. A right is a right. It's not something that Israel is making a favor to. I mean, Israel is occupying for its own interests, and because it's profiting a lot from the status quo. The thing is that I think that a state, I mean, an entity which has displays all the paraphernalia of a state, ministries, and has education, curricula, etc., but then cannot control its border, cannot protect its citizen, is constantly under pressure and at the mercy of a foreign ruler. It's not really it's an imprisoned entity itself. So yes, it has a lot of limitations, and unfortunately, it further aggravates the reality, the living reality in the occupied Palestinian territory. But frankly, I would caution against pushing this false equivalence, which is not yours, of course, but it's in the international discourse. Yeah, but the Palestinians, what the Palestinians do with their own governance, it's Palestinian business. What is the business of the international community is to make sure that Israel take its boots on the ground out of the occupied Palestinian territory and remove the blockade and ensure territorial continuity of the occupied Palestinian territory. This is the international community's business. And if Israel is concerned with its security, fine. The UN have a great experience in securing peacekeeping operations, including truces, including interposition forces. And this is what I'm sure the US will never deny the Israelis.
We have, after Bosnia, after the Balkans, and Kofi Annan was involved in that, we had the development of the responsibility to protect as a doctrine, which was a NEMCON, or almost unanimously adopted at the UN. And we also have the Apartheid Convention, and both of these impose obligations on states to act in cases of apartheid, and also to, if the controlling authority can't protect the people there, then the international community should. So does this offer legal international leverage, or is this something that got to be fought for almost from the beginning?
I mean, personally, I wouldn't even go to, I think that the responsibility to protect has evolved in a way that has not necessarily been what it was originally intended. But I'm telling you, the legal framework, legal architecture that exists, it's absolutely sufficient to prevent and the continuation of the system that Israel has put in place, again, by simply taking measures against the internationally wrongful act. So it's a matter of state responsibility vis-a-vis the violations of human rights law, international humanitarian law, and criminal law. So there should be, on the one hand, the state responding to this, and on the other hand, international criminal justice. The International Criminal Court.
Can I ask a question, which is really, I suppose, about the condition within the Palestinian territories itself, the mood, the frustration, the feeling you suspect that a lot of people will say, yes, we have all of these arguments on our side. We have this great report from this special rapporteur who gets it. But who is going to act? What will happen to make a change for us? Because you do get a feeling of helplessness, and also a feeling that once again, this is coming to a boiling point. We have former Prime Minister Netanyahu promising, if he's re-elected, to annex the settlements in the West Bank. So despite all of the hard work that you're doing, the Palestinians can see that they have right on their side, actually, when it comes down to it, they still remain powerless. So what hope could you give Palestinians as a result of what you've seen and what you've reported and what you've recommended?
Unfortunately, I'm no one to give hope. I'm just a lawyer who tries to make sense of this insanity. I can go as far as pointing to the responsibility of those who are enabling this, and also recognizing their own limitations, hoping that some of them, especially when it comes to the European Union, where I'm sure Europe is very divided among those who see the rupture between politics and law and would like to fix it, and those who are really sheltering Israel from any responsibility. So I don't, unfortunately, seriously, especially now, because it's heavy. This month has been very heavy to watch from here. So I cannot say what to hope for, but if a message I could tell the Palestinians is that I'm mesmerized by their capacity to resist these adversities and to stay calm and decent and whatever they do, because this is really impressive. I don't know how they're managing.
Well, that was one of the issues that I was thinking about and was going to raise anyway, was really, it's almost as though the occupation forces are attempting to provoke overt terrorist behavior on the part of the population. Because I know people have been sort of metaphorically shot for now for suggesting that this behavior on the part of the occupation authorities would many ways justify terrorist activity. If you look at it, terrorism is what you do when there are no other means of getting out of it. That's what happened in many countries across the third world, or many countries under occupation. If you're deprived of all other means of expression, then that terrorism becomes, you know, let's say reasonable and acceptable. And especially if you're a young, desperate kid in the West Bank whose family has been shot, whose village has been bulldozed, it's actually, as you say, it takes a tremendous amount of fortitude not to go berserk. And I think that's a real worry, because the Israelis are building up huge amount of complete resentment and revanchism. If even your funerals are tear gassed and shot and interfered with, you're really treading on some very basic human feelings. And such provocation usually comes with a cost and a riposte from the part of the sufferers.
Yes, and at the same time, Ian, allow me to use some caution. In regards to terrorism, because it's really a category that is used and abused. I know that this is not what you mean, but also for those who listen to us, I'm studying now the counterterrorism legislation, and it's absolutely absurd. You can see that this is really being used to prevent the manifestation of political aspirations and rights. So while there might be a criminal conduct, this should be assessed and judged according to guarantees of fair trial. But at the same time, again, this is a population who's been under occupation for 55 years. So I wouldn't use Israelis categories and Israeli sentencing offenses and sentencing framework to categorize what the Palestinians are doing. I mean, it should be on a case-by-case basis. And of course, attacking civilians might amount to terrorism. I'm not saying that. But again, most of the situations I've seen these days, and again, I still do not have an accurate report that I've produced myself on this issue, is that we should really understand the context here.
After 9/11, and I was living within the sort of rubble fall of the World Trade Center, I remember time after time at the UN and the Security Council, they could not get agreement on what constitutes terrorism.
Yeah,
it's not a legal definition, it's a pejorative term. It means behavior I don't like because it's for reasons that I don't approve of. The British ambassador at the time, he kept telling off the Chinese because they wanted to conflate terrorism with secessionist activities. And he said, no, secessionist activities are not terrorism. They're not even illegal in most countries. So it was continually conflated where everything you disagree. And of course, for most regimes, terrorism is political behavior that you disagree with.
Especially in settler.
A pejorative term, not a legal one.
But especially in settler colonial contexts, there has been, or in occupation context, there's been, this is what I'm studying at the moment. For my next report, there has been quite a vast recourse to counterterrorism legislation to control the population. Mm-hmm. So,
one of our members has just come in with, and it's something we Mark, your fault, my fault. We should have asked about Gaza.
Part of it. I'm not talking of the rest.
We should have asked you to talk about it because, as he puts it, it's the biggest open-air prison Israel has no roots on the ground there, but controls the lives of people in Gaza and the deaths, of course.
And that's from Nabil al-Sharif, by the way.
It's the entire Palestinian territory that it's an open-air prison. Seriously. Mm. There are different regimes. So Gaza is in a solitary confinement, if you want. But the rest, if by prison we intend a place where there is a deprivation of liberty imposed, it's the entire Palestinian territory. There are different regimes of carcerality, but it's all controlled by the occupying power. Mm-hmm. And many of us cannot visit the inmates.
No visitors allowed.
And yeah. Also, don't forget, of course, it's been extremely dangerous for journalists to be covering the situation in Gaza. And many journalists have lost their lives. And of course, you'll recall, Francesca, when the Associated Press building was actually bombed by an Israeli missile. I mean, the story of journalists in the occupied territories is a very, very unhappy one.
Yeah, but there is a nice, I mean, there has been a formal, on this specific case, Mark, there has been a formal submission, I think, by the International Federation of Journalists in the UK to the ICC on asking the Office of the Prosecutor to particularly investigate the targeting and killing of journalists as a special category of crime. And so, one of the cases was the bombing of the Gaza Tower.
Yeah. And of course, our colleague who was shot recently in outrageous circumstances, and the government played the same tricks. We have no evidence. No, we say differently. It's disputed versions. And when the evidence turns up, well, we don't really believe that. And we're not going to do anything about it anyway. And Joe Biden has still done nothing about it, because it's, as the people concerned know, it's pointless having a law if there's no one who's prepared to enforce it. And is there anything that you can think of with the report? You've done a very good job of that persuades the countries of the world that this is something with which we will not put up with, that, up with this we will not put, that we really have to take action. Can we shame them that much, or are they beyond shame, as sadly increasingly seems to be the question?
I'm sure they might feel ashamed, but it was not my intention to shame. My intention is to rock the boat. Because it's enough of, hiding behind a finger. I find it very insensitive above all, which is because, again, we are talking of people's lives. I mean, behind any violation, there is a shattered life. There is a broken something. This needs to end. Because it has been ongoing for generations. I mean, it will take generations to heal the trauma of the Palestinians. In as much as you can see, many Israelis have interiorized, and I totally get it, have interiorized this fear of being targeted. Because for centuries, it's true, for centuries, the Jewish people have been persecuted, and there is no question about that. But again, this cannot be used against another people. There is a moment of reckoning that is to happen, but it cannot be, it shouldn't, again, lead to false comparisons, because it's in no one's interest. So I do want the international community to be part of the solution and not the problem.
Okay, well, Francesca has to go into another meeting soon. Yeah. And as she's probably been all day, I'm sure you're zoomed out by now. It's a cruel and unusual punishment under the US Constitution to be on Zooms all day, as I know from things lately. So
I've also had my first interactive dialogue with member states, which is a lot of emotions.
Is it torture, though?
No, it was good. It was good.
Well,
good.
Congratulations, Francesca. And from us here in Buckingham in England, the Centre for UN Studies, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you for organizing, and to all those who have been patiently with us for this exchange.
Thank you, Francesca, from the Foreign Press Association here in New York. Please join and sign up for more. We're actually going into outer space and another form of settlement, discussing with the Beyond Earth Institute the colonization of space. And we hope that they're not, if we send settlers there, we hope they'll be unarmed and go into, we hope there are no Martians to benefit from this colonization. So that's next Monday. Watch out for more detail. There we are. So I look forward to seeing you all soon. Hope to see you at another of our meetings soon, Francesca. Please let us know what else is coming on. And our commiserations for the bed of nails that you've just landed on.
Thank you all.
Good for the soul, I'm sure. Not good for promotion, but good for the soul.
No, let's leave it. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.